Supercharge your health with the Doctor's Kitchen Cookbook by Dr. Rupi Aujla. Packed with 100 delicious, easy recipes, plus lots of lifestyle tips and information. Available in all good bookshops. Take your first steps towards optimum health today.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast with me, Dr. Rupi, where I'll be discussing the most important topics and concepts in the medicinal qualities of food and lifestyle. These are some of the things that I wrote about in my first book, The Doctor's Kitchen, blending together the science with delicious recipes inspired by cuisines from around the world. The aim of this show is to demonstrate the intersection between nutrition and lifestyle across the breadth of different medical specialties. And today, I'm really, really excited to invite one of my close friends in this crazy field of lifestyle medicine that is burgeoning right now. He is an international bestseller of the book Four Pillar Plan, which I highly recommend you get. He's also the star of the BBC show Doctor in the House, where he actually lived with patients for 30 to 60 days at a time and really tried to understand what was driving the root cause of their conditions. And he's also co-founder of Prescribing Lifestyle Medicine course, the first RCGP accredited course. That's the Royal College of GP accredited course on lifestyle medicine, making a lot of the information accessible to practitioners up and down the country and globally as well. Rong, and welcome to the show, mate.
Rupi, thanks very much for having me on. I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah, mate, totally. And I think it's really interesting because the intro of my first podcast, I talked a bit about how I got into this field myself. I had my own cardiac condition, something called atrial fibrillation. I was offered multiple different treatments by cardiologists and medical physicians. And it was my mum that actually convinced me to optimize my lifestyle as much as possible. So I essentially did a lot of the things that you talk about in your book. I optimized my nutrition, first of all. I concentrated on sleep and hygiene. I essentially try to put my mindset in the best position I could as well. And by optimizing my body's physiology, I was able to overcome something that you wouldn't really associate with lifestyle. And there seems to be like a bit of a running joke that most medics who get into this field have sort of their personal story. And it'd be great to share if you have the same anecdote.
Yeah, well, Rupi, I mean, I think when I've heard you talk about your story before, what's incredible for me is that, you know, your goal actually from recollection wasn't to actually reverse your condition. It was just to optimize your health to get you in the best state possible to have the procedure done.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, in the process, your sort of condition almost, well, vanished, really. It sort of went away. You're right that the doctors that I see in this field tend to have a personal story somewhere. And certainly that's the same for me. To put it in context, I had been working as a doctor for a number of years. I thought I was going to be a specialist. I did all my specialist examinations and was working in kidney medicine. And I was getting a bit frustrated at how super specialized I thought medicine was becoming. So I moved to general practice to get a bit more of a broad overview. I wanted to see everything. How do different symptoms from different parts of the body relate to each other? And how does that have an impact on someone's health? I moved there to general practice, really enjoying my job. And then something happened, really. You know, I was on holiday with my wife. I was on holiday with my, at the time, six-month-old baby boy. And he had a convulsion. His arms went back and it was a very scary time there. We're in a place called Chamonix in France. And, you know, honestly, I thought my son might be choking. So I grabbed him, I turned him over, I tried to slap him on the back, tried to clear his airway. And, you know, really in that moment, I froze. My wife sort of rushed, you know, she screamed up, "We've got to get to hospital." We rushed to the hospital. You could see that the doctors and nurses were incredibly worried because, as you know, Rupi, like six-month-old babies often will have a convulsion if they've got a fever, what we call a febrile convulsion. But he didn't have a fever. And so the big issue was why is this going on? So, you know, we got moved to a different hospital. He had two lumbar punctures. And then a few hours later, the doctor came to see us and said, "Look, what's happened here is that his calcium level in his body is low." I want to say low, I mean really low. So in that hospital, very much like here, the normal calcium level is 2.2 to 2.6. His was 0.97. So just incredibly low. that's what causes convulsion. But then a few hours later to that, they said, we know the reason why. And that's because he had no vitamin D in his body. So, you know, without going into all the ins and outs of that case, in a nutshell, a vitamin D deficiency is a fully preventable deficiency. And I couldn't get my head around the fact that with all my training, with my immunology degree, with my specialist training, with my general practice training, my son, you know, nearly died from a preventable vitamin deficiency. And modern medicine saved his life, right? But they didn't teach me what to do about it. It was a case of, okay, we've dealt with the acute problem. We've given him intravenous calcium. We've given him vitamin D. You know, off you go.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, let me look into this a little bit more. And the more I studied about vitamin D, the more I realized, well, hold on, that's a critical nutrient for the development of our immune system. So has he been low for the past 6 months? Has he been low in the womb potentially? Could this be why he's got such bad eczema? You know, because eczema is in some way a slight misfiring off the immune system, you know. And I went on a mission to basically learn more. I thought, okay, I felt very guilty, if I'm honest, that happened to my son. I thought, how with all my training have I allowed that to happen? So that guilt drove me on. I started reading about vitamin D, about the immune system, 2-3 hours a day. That led me to reading more about the gut microbiome, about nutrition, about lifestyle. And I thought, wait a minute, there's a whole ton of science out there on things that I think are going to help my son, are going to help my patients. Yet as a doctor, I don't know anything about that. And that was quite scary for me. I thought, why do I not know about this? And so literally what drove me on was the desire to get my son back to optimal health as if this had never happened. And I'm, you know, pleased to say, you know, he's nearly 8 years old. He's thriving. He's doing really well. He doesn't have eczema anymore. You know, all these things, you know, that I've applied with him. I've applied the same principles on myself and my family. And I feel as good as I've ever felt. Then I've been applying for years now those principles with my patients. And I'm finding that more and more I'm able to get to the root cause of a patient's problem. Or even if I don't get to the absolute root cause, just by applying some simple changes to their lifestyle, whatever condition they've got can be vastly improved.
Yes.
And so, yes, I've got a personal story.
Yeah.
That's probably quite a long-winded answer for you, Rupi. But, you know, that is really where, you know, if I'm honest, before that incident had happened, I've always had that preference to use lifestyle. You know, I've always had that. But that moment changed everything for me in an instant, because I thought, right, I mean, very few things I think motivate you in life than either a personal illness or when one of your children is ill. You know, that's a pretty powerful motivating factor.
I love the word you used, mission, there. And this is obviously something you started about 8 years ago. Now, you went on a mission to learn as much as you could, not just about vitamin D, but actually why this actually happened. And that led you down, you know, opened a can of worms of all the different research studies, how this relates to the gut microbiome, how it relates to a skin disease that you would never really associate with it, and how this isn't really reflected in current medical curriculum. It's something that, despite all your specialty training, the fact that you're a medical registrar, which is one of the toughest jobs in the hospital, you didn't have that experience in. This must have been the trigger for you to try and open up this information to your patients. It must have really reflected in the current practice or in the practice that you had thereafter, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Because as a medical doctor who, you know, like many of us, we go into this job to help people in as safe a way as possible. You can't unlearn this information. Once you know it, you can't pretend you don't know it. You know, there's an ethical obligation to actually utilize those skills and those new techniques with your patients. And then when you see that actually most of what I recommend now is in the worst case, right? Worst case scenario is you'll know better, but you've done no harm. And then I compare that to a lot of the pharmaceuticals that I used to prescribe on a routine basis. And you look at their side effect profile and you know, even this, the safest drugs that we prescribe have got some pretty nasty side effects, you know. And again, I'm not anti-drugs at all. I'm for using the least harmful recommendation first with my patients and then progressively move it up. You know, the way I see it is that medical school training is brilliant. I'm very proud of my training, but I fundamentally think that it's brilliant primarily for acute disease. And I think, you know, I kind of often wonder, 30, 40 years ago, when you went to see a doctor, I think the bulk of what a doctor was seeing was acute disease. Mm-hmm. So I think our medical training was brilliant for what the health landscape of this country used to be. But I think over the last 30, 40 years, the health landscape has dramatically shifted, whereas now what is putting the NHS under strain and what is coming into your surgery or my surgery every day is basically a lot of problems that are chronic that in some way is related to our collective modern lifestyles. I'm keen, Ruby, to say I'm not putting blame on people. I'm just saying the way society is set up now makes it very hard for many of us to make those healthy choices. And, you know, this is, I'm very lucky to be able to have showcased on BBC One's Doctor in the House that a whole variety of different conditions, whether it's type 2 diabetes, fibromyalgia, mental health problems like anxiety, insomnia, gut problems, menopausal symptoms. Right, in some cases, I managed to reverse these problems in 6 weeks. But in every other case, even if they weren't reversed, they were substantially reduced. Like anxiety attacks and panic attacks have gone down by 70%, right? By applying small changes in four key areas of our lifestyle. So I'm passionate that we undervalue, both as doctors, but across the public as well, we undervalue how beneficial lifestyle changes can be. You know, the science of lifestyle medicine is quite profound, actually. And I think we underestimate its therapeutic importance, because actually some of the take-homes are actually quite simple. You know, we'll probably talk about sleep later, but you know, you can go into sleep and go, actually, when you go into the science of what happens when you sleep, it is incredible. But the take-home is you've got to prioritize sleep and get more sleep.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And so it's not quite as fashionable as some of the high-tech new medical interventions, but the basics of good health, frankly, haven't changed in probably hundreds of years. What has changed is our modern environment.
And I think, you know, the program, Doctor in the House, resonated so well with lots of different medics, particularly GPs, because I know personally, after having my own experience being a patient, being someone that had to be reliant on medications to control something that was out of my locus of control, and understanding as well, there wasn't a clear trigger as to why I was having this heart condition. There wasn't a clear reason as to why it was being perpetuated. When you're in that situation, you manage to improve it yourself, and then you go and see patients. You know, you want to try and apply these principles as much as possible and deliver this information. You get very frustrated with the current arsenal that you have, the current tools in your toolkit of it just being pharmaceuticals, when you know, from your experience, that actually if you just apply these principles of lifestyle, a lot of things can be improved, if not reversed.
Yeah, and Rupi, you just... I remember when you... you know, when we got in touch, I remember it was just before my first series, or maybe it was as the first series of my show went out. I seem to recall you were probably, I think, just started The Doctor's Kitchen, and were contacting me on social media and saying hi and saying you love the program and stuff. And I always got a really nice, warm vibe. You know, as you can tell on social media sometimes, you know, social media is another world altogether, but you can sometimes tell when there's someone who's probably got a similar ethos to you and a similar temperament and, you know, just a similar mission. And I always remember those sort of contacts from you, and they're thinking, oh, there's this guy in Australia who's kind of this Doctor's Kitchen thing, you know. So, you know, just remind me, how did you, you know, what was the impetus for you to set the Doctor's Kitchen up?
I felt very frustrated that I wasn't able to deliver as much information as I could to my patients. So what I found was that, you know, when you entertain these conversations about sleep and lifestyle, you take a little bit longer. Specifically for me, I was writing down recipes for my patients. I thought there's got to be an easier way to do this. So that's when the idea of the Doctor's Kitchen was born. It's probably about 6-7 years ago now, where I could direct patients towards a website where I can motivate them to eat their way to health and actually heighten their knowledge of the clinical research behind the ingredients that I would use to inspire people about how their plates are positive health interventions. So that's when I started. But then, you know, in an era where talking about food and medicine, particularly 6-7 years ago, was very, very niche for a conventional doctor, I didn't want to be labelled as someone that was a bit cavalier, a bit like a cowboy. So that's why it actually took me a while. It took me, well, 4 years later after having the idea, to actually gain the confidence, get behind a camera, start talking about it with as much confidence as as I could. And I started on YouTube and Instagram, as you know, and we connected a couple of months afterwards when I came back from Sydney. And it's kind of just gone from there. But it's really good to be able to connect using social media. I know it's got a lot of caveats as well, but using social media to connect with other doctors who are of this same mind, because it only strengthens the public's understanding of how impactful lifestyle can be.
Yeah, and actually what you say, Rupi, it's amazing how many doctors who are trying to promote this stuff on social media, it's incredible how many also feel very nervous and scared as to what our colleagues are going to think, yeah. You know, because we're training a system in such a way that, you know, these things really bother us. You know, it took me a while to get my head around that, but I think there comes a point when you've studied the science, you know this information, you apply it with your own life, you apply it with patients, and you see the benefits. And I kind of feel, in some ways, ethically obliged to promote this as far and as wide as possible. And I agree with you, the more healthcare professionals that are promoting similar messages, you know, the more it strengthens this idea that this is a thing. You know, social media comes with a lot of criticism. You know, anyone can put advice out there now. Right, but I probably got a slightly different view to what's the norm about that. I think if you rewind back 15 years ago when we didn't really have, I think around 15 years ago, we didn't have social media. Yeah. For most people, they could only get health information from their doctor or from a university or from a book. And now what we've got is that there is arguably too much information out there, but there's, you know, anybody can access free information on health when they go onto the internet. Now, I don't dispute that there might be some problems with that, but I would say by and large, it's much better to have this free and open access to information than it is to have just it reserved behind these closed institutions. And that's why I have a slight problem with the whole idea that we should police what goes out on the internet, because then I think, well, hold on, then we just get back into the same position that we were 20 years ago, where the same thing gets churned out by everyone. It's a lot of people, there's a lot of debate over whether medical doctors have been giving the best dietary advice for the past 20, 30 years. Now, you know, it's a separate conversation, but if we go back to just saying that only the official advice can be then replicated by social media influencers, we're not really having that free and open access of information. So I know there's challenges, but I think by and large, we're living in a great time where lots of people are getting help without needing to even go and see that doctor, which I think is brilliant.
I think that's probably a good thing overall, isn't it? Because I think if people come across this information themselves, it means that they're actually more inspired to learn about the condition, actually overcome it using multiple different ways. And if we were just giving the same dietary information specifically from doctors over the last 20, 30 years, I think some patients would have come to harm. They didn't actually go on those journeys themselves and actually find out different sorts of information from nutritionists and other people that haven't traditionally been heralded as reliable sources of information.
Yeah, and that's how this movement is gaining traction, because what happens is that people start experimenting and experiencing benefits in their own lives. I know so many doctors who, after they were given a health diagnosis, they weren't happy to go on medication for the rest of their lives.
Like myself, essentially.
So they then go and make those changes themselves. They feel better. Then they're more invested in recommending those changes to their patients. And look, there's pros and cons of different movements. And I know the low-carb movement, for example, is something that is, you know, gaining in popularity. And I think there's a few reasons why that is, and we can maybe discuss that. But I think that movement has come about from a lot of doctors, a lot of patients feeling frustrated with, let's say, if they had type 2 diabetes and they weren't really finding any benefit making the dietary changes that maybe they were being asked to make. And when they changed things and did this sort of so-called low-carb diet, they would quickly feel better and find their blood sugar levels come down. So like, oh my God, this is amazing. So they then tell their friends, other doctors. I know some doctors who weren't open to diet and nutrition interventions, and their patients have come back to them and said, look at my blood results. They're incredible. They're like, wow, yeah, that is incredible, actually. Yeah. You know, can I, you know, tell me more? So I think it's not only about doctors teaching patients. I think if we're truly open-minded as doctors, our patients can start teaching us.
Absolutely. And I think that happened with one of our colleagues, Dr. Unwin, who's a quite a well-known low-carber, but he's a very well-experienced GP of 30, 40 years, I can't remember now, and towards the end of his GP career, he's now learning about the therapeutic value of dietary interventions. And that was directly because of patients telling him that kind of story. I've gone on this low carb. I learned about it via the internet. What do you think? These are my blood results. And that ignites interest in him as a medical professional into what the validity of this is and how effective it is as well.
It's a new era, and a lot of people from the audio don't like it because it's a new way of information getting spread. I think, from certainly what I've seen and certainly what I see in my clinic, right, most diet and nutrition and lifestyle changes, I think, you know, you can always try them and see how you feel. And there's very low risk of harm coming from them. That's the way I see it. Now, look, I appreciate that some people, depending on what you see in your clinic, you may, you know, or another healthcare professional, they may have a slightly skewed view depending on what they see. I may have a skewed view based upon what I see, but I recognize that, you know. But I think by and large, this whole movement is a good thing. And most of these profiles are inspiring people to make healthier choices. So I think it's a tricky one. I think it's a tricky area.
I think it's a good segue into what we are going to be chatting about today on the podcast, which is controlling sugar levels or controlling type 2 diabetes specifically. And I know you've had really good experiences with this on a TV show, and you've managed to reverse type 2 diabetes twice using quite different techniques. And I think this is a really good sort of illustration of how multifactorial this condition is, because it's not just diet related, as you're very keen to promote, aren't you?
I'm very keen to promote, and this is really what my approach is about. This is what my book is about. It's about that there are multiple factors in our lifestyle that result in our health. And I think, just as I feel medicine has been overly reductionist for a number of years now with chronic disease, I think something like type 2 diabetes, we're also often calling it a diet-driven condition. And I have issues over that. I mean, I think diet is a critical factor in the development of type 2 diabetes, but I don't think it's the only thing. And if we were having this conversation, Rupi, 5 or 6 years ago, I probably would say, yeah, it's a dietary condition. But my experience is, yes, on Doctor in the House, the BBC television series, but also in my clinic, I've realised more and more that actually some people I see with type 2 diabetes, their diet is frankly brilliant, right? Or they have read some blogs. You know, some of them have read some of your blogs or my blog on, you know, trying to get on top of your type 2 diabetes, and they have made the dietary changes and they've hit a plateau. Mm. They're like, well, what's going on? You know, I thought this was it. And I found that when I address their sleep quality and their stress levels, you can also get improvements in their blood sugar. So I think if we just go back to the start a minute, you know, type 2 diabetes, I think it's always important to understand what is that condition, right? So appreciate many of you listeners may already know, but just if we just go back to basics, you know, type 2 diabetes is a condition where we tend to have too much sugar in our blood, very simplistically. And what causes most of these cases to develop is something called insulin resistance. So the way I like to describe insulin resistance is insulin is a hormone in your body, right? And one of its roles, and it's got many roles, one of its roles is to keep your blood sugar in a tightly controlled range. So for argument's sake, let's say that's between, I don't know, 5 and 7, or, you know, anyway, the numbers don't matter. But, you know, one of the key functions of your body is to keep sugar, your blood sugar, in a tightly controlled range. Too little and you'll feel a little bit dizzy, you'll be faint, you know, you just won't feel so good. And too high, your body doesn't like it, and it can cause problems to all kinds of organs around your body. So the way I like to describe it is this: if you have a little bit of sugar, let's say, or you have a sugary bowl of cereal, right, and you are insulin sensitive, your body just needs a little bit of insulin to bring your blood sugar back down to normal. So you have the bowl of cereal, your blood sugar goes up, and your body gives a little bit of insulin to bring the blood sugar back down to normal. That's what should happen, right? But as you get progressively more and more insulin resistant, so that hormone doesn't work so well, you need more and more insulin to do the same thing. And the analogy I like to draw is with alcohol. So the very first time, you know, you drink a sip of alcohol, right, for those of you who do drink, is that, you know, 1 or 2 or 3 sips of wine, right, or a few sips of beer, and you're feeling a little bit tipsy, right? But as you become a bit more of a seasoned drinker, let's say, right, then you need more and more alcohol to have the same effect. I think most people can kind of resonate with that, right? That's what's going on with insulin. That's kind of what's going on behind the scenes with type 2 diabetes. You need more and more insulin to start having that same effect. And, you know, your body's very smart. That insulin will keep going up for years, and it will still keep your blood sugar tightly controlled. So you won't have a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes. Everything will be seemingly normal, but everything is not normal, right? You're moving towards it. And this is another one of my big frustrations with medicine, is that the way we practice is often things are very black or white. You've either got type 2 diabetes or you're normal. And actually, you know, type 2 diabetes often takes 10 years to develop. Absolutely. And actually, there are markers now that you can pick up that you're not quite optimal, but you're on that path moving towards type 2 diabetes. And I went through that in detail on my TED talk.
Yes, yeah. I was going to say that lovely graph that you've got about how we tend to intervene in the conventional medicine sense quite late on, when the markers demonstrate quite clearly that it's now in the black area, not the white area. Whereas actually, like you said, diabetes in particular can take that 10-year period to actually come to fruition, but during that time, there is a lot of opportunity for us to intervene.
Yeah, and that would be a great model for the NHS and preventive health, is can we intervene earlier? Because what a lot of people don't realise is that, let's say you've not got type 2 diabetes yet, but if your insulin levels are starting to go up, right, if your body's trying to compensate for the lifestyle factors that are driving you to be insulin resistant, right, those prolonged raised insulin levels have been shown to increase our blood pressure, increase our weight, increase levels of a very harmful kind of cholesterol that we call VLDL, very low density lipoprotein, right? So all this stuff is going on in the background even before you get diagnosed as type 2 diabetes. So one thing that frustrates is people go for their NHS health checks and their blood sugar comes back, and then we say, you know, that's normal.
Yeah.
You know, and for example, let me give an example. In the UK, right? So one of the tests that we do, one of the blood markers we do is called HbA1c, you know, 2 to 3 month average of our blood sugar. And roughly speaking, to put it in context, if your level is 6.5 or above, or there and thereabout, you've got a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes. If it's between 6 and 6.5, we call it pre-diabetes. And then under 6 is regarded as normal, right? But here's the point. I've got colleagues who still will report an HbA1c of 5.9 as normal. 5.9 is not normal, right? It's not yet in the pre-diabetic range, right? Although it is in America. In America, actually, their level starts at 5.7. Yeah. But we're sending people home saying everything's okay. And I think we should actually be flagging at that point saying, hey, look, you don't have pre-diabetes or type 2 diabetes yet, but it looks as though you're on the road to developing that soon. Can I help you understand what lifestyle factors are going on that you might be able to change to help turn that ship around? I'm really, really passionate that we need to get... I'm passionate on many levels, Rupi. I'm passionate that lifestyle can help prevent getting sick in the future, but I'm also passionate to say that once you are already sick, lifestyle is a very much underutilized tool to help you get better.
Absolutely. And I think most people might see lifestyle medicine as a soft subject, but as we're about to go into it, you know, there is a lot of scientific study and validity behind these simple or seemingly simple interventions that we can encourage our patients to do. And I think we go back to that traditional situation where we're treating the numbers, we're treating that 5.9, oh, that's normal, without actually thinking about, okay, this is 5.9, what's their sleep like, what's their lifestyle like, what's their BMI or waist to hip ratio. And I think what we could do is go through the four pillar plan. I think it's a good framework to utilize, starting with perhaps sleep and how we can utilize essentially what you write about in your book and apply that to type 2 diabetes, right?
Why I'm so passionate about this four pillar health framework is that I think, you know, you're on the course, the recent prescribing lifestyle medicine course, where that also formed part of the teaching tool that doctors can use with their patients to deliver them a lifestyle prescription. But it also works for each and every single one of us. And I challenge, like, when we go through this, people listening to this, you know, when you hear these four pillars of health, which is food, movement, sleep, and relaxation, you know, a lot of people say, where should I start? I said, well, look at your own life. See which pillar you need the most work in. And most of us intuitively know that. And I say, start there. You know, if your diet is already pretty good, you might be better off prioritizing your sleep for the next 2 weeks rather than trying to make another 5% improvement in your diet. So that's why I like this four-pillar framework. So if we apply this to type 2 diabetes, a lot of people, when we think about sleep, they think, what's that got to do with blood sugar? Well, we know actually, if you haven't had a good night's sleep, okay, first of all, you don't crave fruit and vegetables the following morning, okay? We all know that feeling when we're craving sugary foods, okay? So it's very hard to make the lifestyle change we might want to make when we've not slept. But the other thing is that we now know from studies, if you've had sleep disruption for a week, you can have blood sugar levels similar to a pre-diabetic, right? I think it's really, really important. I'm saying that actually not getting enough sleep causes the same changes in your body, which is basically insulin resistance, which leads to type 2 diabetes. So if you apply this four-pillar framework, then if you've got someone with type 2 diabetes and their diet is brilliant and they're still not getting any better, it could be that there's other levers to turn, and sleep could be one of those levers.
Absolutely.
So, you know, sleep deprivation is a significant stress on the body. So, you know, when you've not slept well and you look what's going on in the brain, you see a collapse of memory, concentration, attention, ability to take in new information, right? A complete collapse of this. That's the same thing that happens when you put someone in a high stress environment, right? So significant changes are happening in your brain when you sleep. We now know in the last years that when you sleep, okay, there's a sewage system that exists in your brain called the glymphatic system, right? And
This is only recently found out.
Very recent.
Because at med school, you know, we didn't realize that there was a lymph system in our brains. And now this, you know, we understand that there is essentially a waste disposal system.
A huge waste disposal system. And it gets really active when we sleep. And, you know, so to put it in layman's terms, you know, as a function of being awake, there's lots of processes going on all the time. And a byproduct of just being awake and doing our thing is that toxic byproducts build up, okay?
Just from normal cell metabolism, yeah.
All of us, like just us being, you know, we've been awake for a few hours, it's already starting to build up in our bodies. So what happens when we sleep for long enough and we sleep deep enough, right? Our body starts to clear out that waste so that we wake up in the morning, hopefully refreshed and ready to go again, right? One of the things that gets cleared out when we sleep is something called beta amyloid protein. Now, look, I know we're talking about type 2 diabetes,
it's really
important is that you guys may have heard of beta amyloid protein because it's the protein that accumulates in your brain in Alzheimer's disease. We know that when you sleep well, right, you remove beta amyloid protein from your brain. And many sleep researchers are now saying that there are causal links between sleep deprivation and the development of Alzheimer's disease. Now, I'm not saying that's the only thing, no, right? But I am saying that many sleep researchers are convinced that that is a key factor that contributes to the development of Alzheimer's.
And I think, again, that demonstrates just how interlinked everything is to those simple lifestyle functions of sleep and dementia and cognitive decline, as well as things like sugar regulation as well. You wouldn't put those two things together immediately. And certainly with a patient, you know, a patient might be seeing a neurologist for this particular problem and an endocrinologist for another sort of problem, but they're very, very interlinked.
And that's why, Rupi, I am super proud that we're both GPs, because, you know, I think we have, look, I think specialism is absolutely required. But I tell you, there has never been a time, you know, certainly for the last 50, 100 years, where generalism has been so important, right? We're living in a time now where people are coming in with multiple problems. And actually, medicine is very set up to refer out to the speciality. And, you know, I had a patient recently who came to see me, and they had a chest problem. And they turned up an A&E the first time with this chest problem, and they were discharged, and they were told, it's not your heart. You don't have a heart attack. You know, go back to your GP. And one of my colleagues had referred them then to see the respiratory physician to see, is it a lung problem? And they went to see the lung problem. They went to see the lung physician, they came back discharged, and this is not a lung problem, maybe go and see a gastroenterologist. Went to see the gastroenterologist, and they said, no, we've done a few investigations, this is not a gastro problem, go back and see a GP. So far, they've had a ton of hospital appointments, a ton of investigations, right? And so far, all they've been told is what this is not. Right, and I feel very proud that actually, GPs, or as I like to call us, expert generalists, you know, I think we've got an expertise in generalism, we're really good at actually putting all these things together and trying to figure out what is the commonality that pulls all these things together. Something came into my head that I'm just going to share with you, Rupi. So on the very first series of Doctor in the House, right, there's a case which really illustrates this point well. There's a 5-year-old boy. He had really bad skin. So he was under a dermatologist. He also had problems with heartburn and indigestion. So he was under a gastroenterologist and he was taking something called omeprazole. So a very strong drug to reduce acid in his body. He was taking every day. This is a 5-year-old boy. He was also under his GP for a different kind of pain, these stomach cramps that kept him off school, right? So he's under 3 different medical professionals and his problems are still ongoing. And I thought, God, I wonder if this is all the same problem. So over 4 weeks, we changed his diet with a view to actually taking the strain off his immune system. So a huge part of our immune system lives in and around our guts. And I thought, could he have a gut problem that is causing his heartburn, that is causing his skin problem, and that is also causing his tummy cramps, right? And literally in 4 weeks, all 3 problems had gone away by addressing his gut and by addressing the immune system in his gut. And, I've got to be really clear. All those doctors were trying to do the best that they could for that boy with the training that they had. But I'm saying, how many times is that happening across the country where actually we're referring out to all these different specialities, whereas a problem can actually, be brought back to one singular problem? And
I think, a lot of GPs are going to be resonating with this kind of story because we're very much in a privileged position where we can see all those different specialties, we can see what their interventions are, and we can also see why they'd want to refer to a respiratory physician or, the dermatologist, etc. Whereas, and I think this is why I love what you're doing with the Prescribing Lifestyle Medicine course, because you're teaching people how to connect the dots. And you're teaching them also within that 10-minute crazy framework that we still have to essentially address what is really driving the condition and actually putting the patient first as well and taking this holistic approach.
Yeah.
And just by virtue of us talking about sleep, we've veered off.
Well, let's get back to sleep, right?
I think sleep, you've illustrated great how important sleep is with reference to type 2 diabetes because and everything else that we talked about, because it does have this relationship to blood sugar dysregulation if we have too much. And there's a cumulative effect as well. And I think certainly one thing you mentioned there with the cravings, when you're sleep deprived, you are more likely to go for those high sugar, high salty, nutrient, low calorific, high calorific foods. And that's, that's really demonstrated well when I'm in hospital and I'm with all my shift working buddies and everyone's reaching for the cakes and the coffee and that kind of stuff to keep us going. Because we crave that when we're sleep deprived.
So on 2 levels, sleep is a problem for type 2 diabetes. On 1 level, it's making you more insulin resistant. When you're sleep deprived, your biochemistry is changing so that you're more resistant to the hormone insulin, right? But also, sleep deprivation affects you because you're unable to make good lifestyle choices like your diet or, you don't feel motivated to exercise, which is also going to contribute to your type 2 diabetes. So on so many...
It's a double whammy.
It's a double whammy. So that's what why I'm so passionate about sleep. If we go into stress, which is another one of my pillars, again, stress has a huge role to play in type 2 diabetes. And I think that is one of the reasons, if you look around society now, when we are, we're underslept and we're overstressed, I think this also helps to explain why so many people are struggling with type 2 diabetes, with pre-diabetes. I personally don't think that we can explain it all with just food. When you understand the biochemistry, these other lifestyle factors, so, very simply, the stress response is a good thing. So the stress response has evolved in a time to help us, fight or flight. So on an evolutionary level, let's say we're being attacked by a lion. Our stress response goes up. Our cortisol, which is one of our primary stress response hormones, goes up. Our adrenaline levels go up. And these things make us, and they turn us into the best version of ourselves, right? So this is a good thing. We can run faster. Our muscular strength goes up. Our brain function goes up. We pour out sugar into our blood to help give us energy.
Exactly.
Well, that's a great thing if it's there for 30 minutes or an hour. If we use it to run away from the danger, then everything comes back down to normal. The problem is in the modern world, right, it's not lions that are attacking us, it's our life. Right? So whether it's your to-do list, whether it's your email inbox, right? Whether it's the fact that you've had people try and contact you on WhatsApp, on Facebook, on Twitter, and they still can't get hold of you. So they're then trying to, you know...
Phone your mum.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And all this kind of constant pressure, which so many of us feel now, yeah. Right? These things are stressors on us. A lack of sleep is a stressor on us. So those things that help in the short term to help get us away from danger, in the long term, they become problematic.
It's this sort of like cumulative effect of low-grade stressors that are chronic over a long period of time that lead to those sort of physiological changes that you beautifully explained there, with sugar being dumped into the blood system, that can lead to issues with long-term blood dysregulation, type 2 diabetes.
Yeah. Chronic stress, for example, you know, and this is where you've got to be careful. Acute stress, so short-lived stress, is a good thing. A chronic stress is problematic. And that then, that suddenly pouring sugar into your bloodstream, which is a good thing for half an hour while you're trying to run, is not such a good thing day after day, week after week, you know, month after month. And this is why this contributes to the development of type 2 diabetes. And can I just say about a patient I saw recently? Because I think it really illustrates sleep and stress really, really well. I appreciate we've not spoken about food yet, but this is a 52-year-old man, right? Busy IT executive, right? And he had basically been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes by his GP. And he started off on medication. And then he actually read, I think, one of my blogs. And he started making changes with his diet. And his blood sugar starts to come down and he felt really good. You know, he was still on, I think, metformin, which is one of the medications that we use for type 2 diabetes. But he was plateauing and he was getting a bit frustrated. So he turns up at my door, right? So I see him and I go through his diet. And it was, frankly, pretty damn good, right? He was very much following what would be called a low-carb approach. Okay, he'd read other blogs as well and he thought, okay, type 2 diabetes is a carb issue, so I need to cut down my carbs, right? So he was on a very low-carb diet. And I looked at his lifestyle and I applied this four-pillar framework on him. And he was also pretty active, right? So I thought his diet was good. He was pretty active. But then he was a busy executive. His sleep was disrupted every night. He was always on the go and his stress levels were through the roof. And I said to him, look, you know what? If we apply this four-pillar framework on you, actually, food and movement are not the issues, right? Sleep and stress can absolutely be impacting your diabetes. He was so shocked. He thought I was going to tell him to go keto or actually reduce his carbs even more. And I said, you know what? I think your diet is good enough. Just by giving him some simple stress management and sleep techniques, so he'd have 90 minutes every evening. No, he wouldn't agree to 90 minutes, but we compromised on 1 hour. So 1 hour before bed, he had downtime. He'd switch off his work emails and he'd switch off his technology for 1 hour before bed. And I also made a deal with him that he would go on a meditation app for 5 minutes a day. Right, not 20 minutes, right? 5 minutes a day. And I'm not kidding you, right? He came back 6 weeks later. His carbohydrate content had gone up because I said, ease off on being that aggressive with your carbs. I think that's stressing you out even more. He increased his carbohydrate intake. His stress levels went down. His sleep quality went up and his blood sugar started to come down. And by doing that, about 4 months later, I'd managed to get him off his metformin and his blood sugar was in the so-called normal range, right? So I'm selling that because if anyone's listening or they've got a family member or a parent who is trying to follow a diet that they've read on the internet and they're stalling with their blood sugar, do not underestimate these four pillars and look at those other ones, which maybe we're not looking at. And we've all got, hey, you love food, I love food, right? We've all got our own biases. We, you know, I like eating well, but you know, the relaxed pillar, the stress thing is just something I struggle with.
And I think it's something that a lot of people struggle with and they don't recognize just how important it is. And just while you were talking there, it reminded me of something that I've always been told throughout my childhood by my mum, is never eat in a stressed state. And now there's evidence to show that if you are eating in a stressed state, your glucose level is going to take longer, your sugar level is going to take longer to go back to normal after you finished eating cooking your food. And it kind of also ties in with almost like the French paradox, for example. So the French always take a long time for their lunch. They're not the sandwich grab and go sort of culture. They take their time, they read the paper, they might have a cigarette at the same time. Not advocating that.
They seem to get away with it.
They seem to get away with a lot, yeah. But they have this sort of relaxed moment. Whereas in the UK, and I'm not saying this is the reason why we're having such high rates of diabetes, but in the UK, we do tend to rush our mealtimes. We eat in a stress state and we continue that stress state that can be having an impact on our sugar levels.
Yeah, Rupi, on that, if you think about the running away from a lion, right? So what does the stress state do? Yes, all these other things, it sort of fires up. So our speed and our brain and things, right? But it also shuts off things that we don't need in that moment. So, you know, reproduction, for example, gets shut down. So, you know, because you don't obviously feel the need to reproduce when there's a lion attacking you, but your digestion gets shut down as well, right? So if you think about that, if we are in a stressed state and we're trying to eat, our body is already switching off digestion, saying, actually, that's not a priority for the body now. The priority is to fight or flight. And I'd say one thing actually that's really relevant here is something I discovered whilst filming the two series of Doctor in the House. I would go around the UK and I spent a lot of time with different families. And one thing I noticed in a lot of them is people don't sit round and eat dinner around a table much anymore, right? In fact, in the first series, the lady who had type 2 diabetes, which their family, right? I remember the very first day I got there, you know, it's first filming day I've ever had, and I'm there and I'm like, you know, got these cameras on me. And I said, hey guys, what, you know, what would you normally eat? And the guy said to me, the dad said, he turned around to the family, he said, hey guys, you know, what do you want? Just the usual tonight. Yeah, yeah, usual please, dad. So he says, right, come on, Doc, we get in the car. Right, we drive 15 minutes out of town to a McDonald's, right? We go through the drive-thru. The guy spends £48, right? This is in 2015, £48 on food for four people. So husband and wife and two teenage kids. And then we drive home. Now, that's you know, the nutritional content is one thing we can talk about. Yeah. But the more important, well, the fascinating thing for me is that when we got back, everyone had their meals and they didn't sit and eat together. So the teenage daughter, I think, was on the corner of the sofa scrolling social media whilst scoffing her McDonald's meal. I think the son was at the dinner table, but he was also sending emails whilst he was eating. The husband and wife weren't sitting together. I think the mum, I think, was watching TV whilst eating, and the dad was doing something else, right? And I'm telling you, right, I made one of my recommendations that I made with these guys, the same as one of the chapters in my book, which is try and reclaim your dining table. Try and eat one meal a day, if possible, around a table. I tell you, I found that when I did that with all these families around the country, they would report back to me incredible benefits. I said, oh, you know, we're eating less, right? Because we're sitting down, talking to each other. So many couples said to me, you know what, I'm actually closer to my wife now, I'm closer to my boyfriend, you know, I'm actually, you know, actually we're connecting, we're actually finding out about our day. And, you know, yes, I think you eat less, and there's some studies which are showing that when you eat in company around a table, right, you actually eat, you consume less calories, which makes complete sense to me. Yeah. But I think it helps lower stress levels as well. And I'm passionate that it's these little things that add up. I get it. Not everyone lives with other people, right? But can you, for one meal a day, sit around, whether it's with your work colleagues, put your phone away, and actually maybe take a leaf out of the French, exactly, and just say, just sit down and enjoy your meal.
Yeah, totally. And I think, like you said, there are some tangible benefits that we can actually refer to clinical studies about the fact that it's slowing down the eating process and the digestion and everything, but there are some intangibles there that are very hard to essentially explain. But people anecdotally report back and they're like, you know what, I learned more about my partner, for example, or I ate less, or I felt much more satiated earlier on. It's really, really interesting that, and I think we need to probably segue onto exercise now. We could talk probably about each fellow for ages, but what you were talking about there, the fight or flight, and how that leads to our higher stress levels. What I found actually from my personal practice is a lot more people are doing quite aggressive training regimes to try and essentially rid themselves of, in the case of type 2 diabetes, try and exercise their way out of a problem, whereas as I'm sure you've probably found this as well, sometimes it's the quality of the exercise, it's the variation of exercise, not just HIIT training the whole time, because that's been shown to be the best thing for sugar.
Yeah, anything, any intervention, any lifestyle intervention has got a perfect dose. And exercise is no different. But that dose also depends on the context of your life. So if you were super busy, super slammed all the time, you're not sleeping enough, you're already, you know, depleting the reserve that you've got, right? You may find that you get much more benefit from a form of exercise that restores you and rejuvenates you, like yoga, let's say, for example, than going and having a HIIT workout. You know, I had a patient recently, early 40s she was, right? She was a single mum, and she was working two jobs, and, you know, she was struggling with her weight and had done for many years. Now, she had jumped from diet to diet, trying to find, you know, the right one, and, you know, nothing would work. She jumped to a different one. And what was really interesting for me is that when I saw her, you know, we made some dietary changes, and her diet was frankly pretty good again. And she wasn't losing weight, but what she had done 2 months prior to that is hire a personal trainer. So this is someone who wasn't flush with money, but was really concerned about her health. So she hired a personal trainer for 1 hour, three times a week. And she was hitting it hard, and she was going, and, you know, she was doing things. And I think I talk about her in the book, actually, and about body attack and thigh burn. And, you know, the way I describe it is that these workouts were attacking her.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And she couldn't lose weight. And what was her PT doing? Her personal trainer was pushing her even harder, saying, you know, you've got to work harder. And clearly she had thought, as she has heard from the media over a number of years, that it's diet and exercise. And I said, hey, look, you know what? You are so busy. You're a single mum. You've got two jobs. You're running around all the time. I think you're deplete. I don't think you've got the reserve to deal with those kind of workouts. And, you know, I brought up yoga with her, and God, you should have seen the look on her face. She's like, how's that going to help me lose weight? Come on. You know, so she was really skeptical. She wouldn't go for it initially. And then a few weeks later, she's like, okay, look, all right, go on. I'm going to hear you out. Tell me. And I said, look, I think your body's too stressed. I think the workouts you're doing with your PT are actually putting more stress on your body. It's keeping you more in fight or flight. And if you're chronically stressed, your body won't let go of weight. We know there's lots of correlational studies with high cortisol levels, that stress response hormone, and increased body weight. So then I said, look, can you just cut your personal trainer out for 2 months? Right. So she agreed, right? She stopped doing it, and she went to two yoga sessions a week, right? 4 weeks later, she's lost over a stone. Right. And I see this over and over again. For her, at that time in her life, right, a yoga session was much better for her than going hard with a PT three times a week. It may be that if her lifestyle changes, right, she only has one job, she gets a lot more sleep, she may then tolerate hitting it hard in the gym. And I think it's really important that exercise has the right dose and the right context.
Exactly. And I think it's kind of trying to teach patients to become more intuitive about their lifestyles themselves, so they can make those educated decisions about whether a HIIT session first thing in the morning is appropriate for them, given what they're trying to achieve, whether that be improving their sugar levels, improving their stress levels as well. And I think even though there's some really interesting stuff about HIIT training in particular, it might not always be the best thing for you. And it's that personalization is super important.
Absolutely. And if we sort of just, if we're back on type 2 diabetes for a second, one thing I would say that I'm doing more and more with my type 2 diabetic patients is prioritizing with them and really focusing on them on strength. Right, strength training is very much undervalued in society.
Absolutely, yeah.
And, you know, scarily, once we hit the age of 30, you know, we can lose up to 5% of our muscle mass every 10 years if we're not active enough. But that's incredible from the age of 30, right? And why is that important in type 2 diabetes? Well, the more lean muscle you have, the more insulin sensitive you're going to be. The more, if you think about it in another way, the more cupboard capacity you've got to dump that sugar into. You know, it's not, maybe not the best analogy, but really, you know, lean muscle is really, really important in type 2 diabetes. So when I talk to diabetic patients, I always prioritise a form of strength training. And I don't know if we've spoken about it before, but one of the big hits from my book has been the 5-minute kitchen workout, which is basically a strength workout that anybody can do, right? No matter what your age, right? You can modify it for all ability levels. You don't need to join a gym. You don't need to buy any equipment, right? And if you don't want to get changed, you don't even have to get changed. So I'm all about, you know, making things accessible for people, right? If you want to go and hit the gym 40 minutes, 3 times a week, go for your life, right? I love that as well. But recently I've not had time. So I will, you know, I will kick out this 5-minute kitchen workout. Like that's what I said in a hotel in London. I did it there this morning in my hotel room. It's a way I stay fit and keep in shape, even if I can't get to a gym.
Exactly.
And I've got patients who are 70 years old and or 20 years old who are doing this because it makes it accessible for them. And that's what I think you're about as well, Ruby. It's like, I love giving advice, but I'm more interested in the advice that people feel they can actually do in real life.
Totally. And making those sorts of like movement hacks readily available to people, you know, even if it is taking the stairs instead of the escalators or the 5-minute kitchen workout or just, you know, taking a walk and a stop earlier from your tube stop or bus stop or whatever, those little things do add up. And actually, because we are designed to move, you think again from an evolutionary perspective, we are designed to be moving or a lot of the day. And unfortunately, given our sedentary lifestyles, the fact that we're indoors, we're usually sat down, it's very hard to achieve that these days, and you have to be a bit more mindful about it.
Yeah.
I love the fact that we've talked so long about type 2 diabetes and we haven't even got to
the food yet. That's incredible.
That's great. And I think we could have talked about all the other stuff for even longer, but the food, I think, is particularly interesting because, like you said earlier, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, you may have been on the low-carb approach, but your thinking about this has changed quite a bit, particularly with reference to the gut microbiome, immunity, meta-inflammation, this low-grade chronic inflammation.
Yeah, you know, I think all of us, you know, as we go through our careers, our viewpoint evolves as we learn more science and we see more patients, you know, and you know, I've been practicing now for nearly 17 years, so I've seen tens of thousands of patients, and so I'm always looking for what advice works, what doesn't, what bucks the trend. And so, yeah, 5 years ago, you know, I personally have never used the term low carb, and the reason is because I think we have unfairly demonized fat. And I think we're potentially doing the same thing with carbs. So, you know, you just, you know, very simplistically, you can have good fat, you can have bad fat, you can have good carbs and bad carbs, you know. And again, good and bad are probably aren't the best terms either. But yeah, the point is, I don't necessarily think that that term tells you that much. But yes, 5 years ago or so, I would often, with my type 2 diabetic patients, use what would be considered a low carb approach. Right? So that would be refined and processed carbohydrates. I would really aggressively cut them out with my patients, and I saw great improvements quickly in their blood sugar. But as I think about this more and more, and I've got lots of friends in the low carb movement, right? And I think they're doing a lot of good, right? But I don't necessarily agree with absolutely everything. I don't think carbs are evil. If carbs were the only issue in type 2 diabetes, we have to be able to explain why in Okinawa in Japan, one of the blue zones, so blue zones are these sort of little pockets around the world where we've got these high rates of longevity. So people live to a ripe old age with minimal rates of these chronic diseases like type 2 diabetes. How can the Okinawans have an 80% high carbohydrate diet and not have type 2 diabetes? And I think I can explain that. I think the reason is it's not just about carbs, right? So the first thing to say about them is the Okinawans are also very well slept. Yeah. They've got low levels of stress. They're physically active every day, right? So on the other three pillars, except from food, they're maxed out anyway. So they're not doing the other things, right, that would drive insulin resistance, which drives type 2 diabetes, right? But the other thing is the carbs that they're eating are what I would call cellular carbohydrates. So there was a great paper by Ian Spreadbury in 2012 where he sort of hypothesizes, are the helpful carbs primarily the cellular carbs? These are ones where their structure remains intact, so like sweet potatoes, as opposed to the modern, what he calls acellular carbs, such as rice cakes and highly processed grains, for example, where actually the structure of the plant has been changed. And I'm not saying that's the perfect way of differentiating them, but I think, well, we know that sweet potatoes are very, very good for our gut microbiome. And so I should probably back up and go, what's the gut microbiome, right?
Yeah.
So, man, there's so much to talk about, isn't there, Rupi? We're trying to cram a lot in.
Actually, I talked about the gut microbiome, which is the population of microbes living in and around your body, largely concentrated in your gut, in a former episode on
series 1. So your listeners might know.
They might know, but you can listen to that again. It's with a mutual friend of ours, Dr. Megan Rossi. And we talked about gut health on that one. But yeah, in short,
we've got trillions of bugs living inside our guts, right? And we know that the health of those gut bugs is critical for multiple processes in our body. It's critical for our digestion, which is in our gut, but it's also critical for things outside our gut, such as our mood, potentially even skin, potentially even joint pain, potentially even other things such as type 2 diabetes. And there's some interesting research suggesting that your gut microbes might be implicated in your weight, right? So we're learning more and more. This is very early science, new science, how important that collection of gut microbes is. But what's interesting for me is that if you look at any healthy eating population around the world, they're all basically following the same principles, not when it comes to fat or carbs, right? Because there's differences.
Yeah.
You know, one of the blue zones is Loma Linda in California, and they're vegetarian. But, you know, other blue zones eat animal products. Now, yeah, I know the books say that they don't eat many animal products, but, you know, we were both in Guernsey in June, and I spent some time with Michel Poulin, who's the Belgian researcher who coined the term blue zone. And guys, in some of those blue zones, they have quite a lot of animal products, right? So I think, okay, so, you know, what's the commonality? They're eating minimally processed food. So food that is as close as possible to what we get in nature, right? And I know not everyone loves the term processed or unprocessed food, but, you know, no one loves any term, frankly. You know, you can't keep everyone happy. You know, I've realized that minimally processed food, they try and eat locally. They try and eat seasonally. They sit down and have their meals, and they do have treats, right? But they have treats every now and again. Exactly. They have treats like at Easter or at Christmas. They don't have treats every day after school, for example.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. So I think when you look at the blue zones, it's this balanced perspective. And I think a good low carbohydrate diet, right, or what is called a low carbohydrate, and again, I'm not a huge fan of the term. I get it that it's easy to understand, but you can have a good quality one where you're having loads and loads of vegetables that feed our gut bugs. And, you know, there's some really good studies that's showing that one of the initial causative events in the development of type 2 diabetes might be problems with your gut microbiome, right? That's incredible, right? So if you've got a healthy gut bug population, right, does that in some ways insulate you? Is that why the Okinawans could have 80% carbs?
Exactly.
Because they're nourishing their gut bugs. And, you know, if you really want to delve deep into it, there's inside our gut bugs, we've all got a compound called LPS, lipopolysaccharide, right? So sitting inside you now, sitting inside me, sitting inside everyone, we've got LPS, right? But LPS is fine if it stays in your gut. But as we start to damage our gut bug population, and what damages it? Highly processed food, right? Overuse of antibiotics, pollution, right? Often some of these sweeteners now that we're using a lot, they can be quite damaging for the gut microbiome. As we damage that, right, we start to cause issues with the integrity of our gut wall, and lipopolysaccharide, this LPS, suddenly can get into our body. And that's where it's been associated with the development of type 2 diabetes. It's been associated with things like rheumatoid arthritis. It's been associated with Alzheimer's disease and other neurodegenerative diseases. And in many ways, once you start understanding this, you think, wow, our gut, if we can keep that in good shape, right, our gut bugs and our gut health, actually, we, in some ways, we're probably going to insulate ourselves from many of these modern different diseases. And how can you do that? Well, diet is a big role.
It's a huge role. Exactly, yeah. And I think, like, we could talk about the gut microbiome in its entirety. Essentially, if we're distilling it into simple principles, whether it is described as low carb or there's other diets that are carb rich, like the Okinawan diet, it's really about the quality of those ingredients and keeping it as least from the ultra processed foods as possible and less refined as possible, keeping it as whole as possible.
Absolutely. You know, it's like when you're trying to write a book, you sort of really have to order your thoughts. because it's all very well having ideas. And when you have to articulate it on paper, you're like, okay, I have to put these thoughts in some kind of order where it makes sense. And I hypothesize that could it be in the modern Western world where we are overstressed, underslept, not moving enough, having a lot of highly processed junk food, could it be in this environment that this low-carb role, that this low-carb diet has such a powerful role in some patients? I think it is. I think here now, you know, we both live in the UK. I think the bulk of the junk that is in the British diet is highly processed and refined carbohydrates. So the question I ask is, when you go on a low-carb diet in the UK, are the benefits because you've cut your carbs or you've cut out the highly processed junk?
Exactly.
And I think that's another way to look at it. And, you know, look, there's no question, if you were a type 2 diabetic patient in my clinic, I may well restrict some of your refined and processed carbohydrates for a couple of months, right, to really get on top of the problem. But then what I'm also trying to do is optimize those other four factors and try and repair that insulin resistance so you become more insulin sensitive. And then I start to reintroduce some of those starchy carbohydrates like sweet potatoes and parsnips that, you know, on some low carb diets they would say go away from. But I think they've got a very positive impact on our gut health.
Exactly.
So some people can absolutely get away with introducing them in. And I've also got patients, if I'm honest, who do a low fat vegan diet
and
reverse their type 2 diabetes as well.
And this is what is interesting, because in my book I actually talked about the validity of different diets or the invalidity of different diets, and I think it really depends on that patient in front of you and the fact that there are quite a few similarities across all of them. Like whether you look at paleo or whether you look at veganism, they have a lot of things in common, like concentration on nutrient dense sources of foods, lots of different variety of vegetables and whole foods as much as possible, and removing those things like refined sugary drinks as well as refined processed carbohydrates. So, you know, I think the diet wars are sort of like busying the situation. They actually serve to confuse rather than to educate people. And if you stick to those simple principles that you've eloquently described, you can do a lot of good.
Yeah. But just the last thing to say on type 2 diabetes, it's really important, I think, for people listening, is that there's another approach that's got a ton of research behind it. Professor Roy Taylor at Newcastle University has reversed type 2 diabetes with a liquid 600 calorie diet for a few weeks. I think it's 2 or 3 weeks, right? Now, for me, as you just said, Rupi, it comes down to, you know, that's not an approach I use with my patients. A, I don't have access to that. But B, I would much rather they learn some tools in their own lifestyle that they can apply long term. But I also have to recognize that that approach works, right? So what does that mean? There are multiple ways to use lifestyle to get on top of your type 2 diabetes. You've got to figure out what works for you. You know, if you're someone who wants to be a vegan and have a low fat diet, right, let's say, actually, if you can stick to a low-fat diet and a low-calorie diet, actually, you've got a good shot at reversing your type 2 diabetes. The thing I see is quite a few people struggle to stick to some of these low-fat diets, especially if they're highly processed. So there's all this nuance there that I don't think the diet wars really take into consideration.
Like I said at the start of the podcast, The Four-Footed Plan, I think, is a fantastic book. And what you're doing with the Prescribing Lifestyle Medicine course is really equipping the doctors, like ourselves, like GPs, but also different specialties to look at conditions in a completely different way and incorporate these really simple yet effective approaches at helping our patients. And I can't promote your course enough, and I think it's going to do fantastically well. Do you have anything coming up over the next... Oh, you've got your book launch in America, obviously.
Well, the book's about to be launched in America. The US publisher have gone for a slightly different title. They're calling it How to Make Disease Disappear. It's essentially the same book as The Four-Pillar Plan. It's got a different introduction. But, you know, having seen the impact that this book is having in the UK, the amount of people who are getting it, who are buying multiple copies for their parents and their work colleagues and their brothers and their sisters, you know, I'm just keen to get this message out and as far and as wide as possible. And clearly the US population absolutely need help with lifestyle-driven conditions. And I'd like to think that why my book, I think, is resonating with people is that it's What I've tried to do is break down and simplify health for people. I think health has become so complicated. I've really tried to use this four-pillar framework to simplify it so that people feel inspired that as they're reading, oh God, I want to make that change. I want to make that change. And so I'm excited to see, you know, if this takes off with the US population. But apart from that, you know, just more of the same, more posts on Instagram and Facebook, you know, trying to promote this work.
Absolutely, yeah. And thank you so much for your work. And I appreciate coming to the podcast, buddy. It's been brilliant. That was an awesome chat I had with Dr. Rungan, or Rungan as I call him. He's an absolute wealth of knowledge. His book's fantastic. And I'm really glad that we got to utilize that framework to illustrate why lifestyle is so important. To round up what we were talking about, our sleep is so important. So it's not really about the number of hours, it's about the quality and the mindset that you go into your sleep in. So having a focus on improving your sleep, perhaps by removing electronics an hour to 2 hours before you go to bed, dimming the lights and making sure that you're not exciting your brain, is something that can actually help with sugar regulation. Exercise is very important to maintain overall health, improve your cardiovascular health, but also over-exercising, in particular high-intensity training, too often can be detrimental. So it's something that you want to try and realize whether this is something that you want to do all the time. I think HIIT training is fantastic. It certainly improves insulin sensitivity. There's really good evidence for that. But having a variety of exercise is super important. So doing things like yoga, stretch, flow, mobility exercises, as well as traditional endurance, whether that be running, cycling, or rowing. Having a mindfulness or meditative strategy is something that a lot of people could do with. And this can be as simple as taking time out of your day, 10 minutes, to just allow yourself to experience inner calm, putting away your electronics, making sure that you're giving yourself time to be still within yourself. Some people find using an app is very effective, or some people find just going for a walk and being in a green space can be very therapeutic. And there is some evidence to suggest that having this inner calm can improve your stress levels, that can improve your ability to deal with sugar. There are so many different ways in which you can improve your diet to improve your sugar regulation. Having a more whole and less processed diet is something that focuses on different sorts of whole vegetables, even things like sweet potato and root vegetables with the skins on as well, can be very effective at improving your microbiome, but also improving the numbers of different fibers that you have in your diet. Beans, legumes, these are all fantastic at improving your fiber and also regulating sugar in your bloodstream. Having a nutrient-dense diet by introducing different sorts of colors, the greens, the yellows, the purples, are ways in which you can improve the anti-inflammatory context of your diet that can have improvement on your sugar levels as well. If I was to choose a recipe from the book, it would be the bolotti bean soup. It's got lots of different herbs and spices in, and it's made up largely of beans, which are fantastic from a fiber point of view and a protein source as well. I really hope you like listening to that podcast. There's going to be loads more coming up, and make sure you subscribe to The Doctor's Kitchen. You can find my guest, Dr. Rungan Chatterjee, at Dr. Chatterjee on Facebook, Instagram, and make sure you check out his book, The Four Pillar Plan, too.